MacCast, Sunday, July 26th, 2020. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to be back here with you for another week of Mac news and information. How are you doing? I hope you're having a great weekend, whenever you might be getting around to listening to this podcast. Looking over the show notes this week, definitely have some fun things to talk about. We're going to get into iPhone SE sales. Some interesting numbers there, interesting things to talk about. We're going to talk about possible new Macs that might be on their way very soon. So always exciting to get to some new Mac models in the lineup. We knew Apple was working on some things. We'll talk about what that might be, and it might surprise you a little bit. We're also going to talk about the greening of the Apple supply chain, Apple making some more environmental initiatives this week, upcoming iPhones and some features both far in the future, and those 2020 iPhones. We've got more rumors coming up. Of course, there are some Apple TV Plus news to get into, and some new information coming out of a feature that was announced at Worldwide Developer Conference, specifically regarding the Find My App functionality, and a little controversy that dusted up. We'll talk about that a little bit, and that'll kind of round out the news, and then we're going to get into some feedback. I want to talk a bit about Apple Silicon and something that I've gotten wrong and was pointed out by a member of our Apple community very succinctly. I want to talk about what he said and just give you the rundown on the whole story behind Apple and ARM and Apple Silicon and that relationship. And then we have a number of questions about iCloud this week. A couple questions, one relating to iCloud drive and storage and optimizing your storage, and then we'll finish up with another question just about more in general about how iCloud drive works and how you can benefit from it and some possible gotchas when you're turning iCloud features on and off. So it should be a great episode. Before we get into everything, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is Linode. Hey, if you're looking to set up a server, a great way to do that is with Linode and their Linode Cloud. You can instantly deploy and manage an SSD server in the Linode Cloud. You can get a server up and running literally in seconds with your choice of Linux distribution, resources, and in any of their 10 node locations. Best of all, they're giving all new MacCast customers a $20 credit, so you can get up and running right away and check out all they have to offer. And that's a lot. Basically, with Linode, you have all the options and choices to build a server with the services and features you need. Whatever your requirements, you can build it on Linode. Dedicated CPUs, distributed applications, hosted services, websites, continuous integration, continuous delivery environments, they can handle it all with native SSD storage, a 40 gigabit network, and industry-leading processors. Like I said, you can pick from any of their 10 worldwide data centers to set up your Linode, and pricing is simple with no surprise fees. You pay just for what you use with hourly billing across all of their plans and add-on services. And their new cloud manager features an improved user interface, which makes managing your Linodes and upgrading your plans even easier. Visit linode.com/maccast to set up your first Linode and get a $20 credit. That's linode.com, linode.com/maccast to set up your Linode, and a big thank you to Linode for their support of the MacCast. The iPhone SE, I think it's the little iPhone that could. Their sales are looking pretty strong in the latest numbers from a survey coming from Consumer Intelligence Research Partners. They show that Apple's iPhone SE is proving to be the preferred entry-level device for many consumers out there. I know some of you are among them. The numbers for April to June quarters indicate that the iPhone SE, with a starting price of $399 US, is taking over for devices like the three-year-old iPhone 8 or the iPhone XR. People are tending to prefer the newer iPhone SE, and that attractive starting price point. As a matter of fact, the iPhone SE in that same quarter accounted for 19% of all of Apple's iPhone sales. So the good news is that the iPhone SE is doing well. The even better news is that it doesn't seem to be taking away from the premium sales or the sales of Apple's premium phones. It just seems to be filling the gap for consumers who are more price conscious and looking to upgrade from an older device. Now, there was some other data this week from Counterpoint Research. It was talking about Apple's sell-through for the last quarter, and unfortunately, it was overall down about 23% year over year, likely a result of the pandemic and all the things that are going on in the world. But what was interesting is their numbers also seemed to back up the CIRP numbers. Their report also noted that the iPhone SE was a, quote, bright spot in the numbers, selling very well and enticing Android users, with over 26% of buyers of the iPhone SE coming from Android. So again, it's really appealing to the entry-level consumer, the consumer switching from Android, and the person who has maybe is on an older iPhone and looking to upgrade, but not in the market for Apple's premium models. So it seems like Apple has really got the right mix with the iPhone SE and the new lineup of the iPhone 11, iPhone 11 Pro, and the iPhone 11 Pro Max. And even though, you know, overall phone sale numbers are down a bit, it's looking pretty rosy, and it's pretty cool to see the iPhone SE kind of filling that spot. It's a really nice phone, and I know a lot of folks out there really like it. As you know, coming off Worldwide Developer Conference, we have a lot of buzz focused on Apple's new Apple Silicon-based Macs coming later this year. But we do also know, and Tim Cook even mentioned this, that Apple still has some Intel-based Macs in the lineup, and we are expecting some updates, and it's looking like this week we may get a little peek at those, at least if some of the Apple leakers are to be believed. Our newest Apple leaker we've been talking about here on the MacCast, Love to Dream on Twitter, says those products are on the way. A few other leakers this week on Twitter, maybe less reliable, said we could even see those new machines next week. What are they going to be? Well, it was believed that Apple may have had some hardware ready to go right around Worldwide Developer Conference and held off, and it's believed that those machines are likely new iMacs. There have been a few other indications and signs as well that they might be iMacs. We saw a week or so ago an unannounced iMac with a 10-core Intel i9 CPU and a Radeon Pro 5300 GPU show up on Geekbench, and also iMacs have been constrained in the supply chain for the last couple months. I know when I was looking to upgrade my Mac and get a new Mac, I wasn't able to get a really good ship time on an iMac, and so I ultimately opted to go with a MacBook Pro. And I think those long wait times, those long ship times have continued. And that can often be a sign that Apple is slowing down production in preparation for some new models. Not always an indication, but could be what's going on. There haven't been any real specifics about what a new iMac would look like, but it was believed that the iMac line was going to get a refresh with possibly a new design with reduced bezels. Now, that rumor is in contention a little bit. Some people believe that an update coming this year to an Intel Mac would be just that, a hardware refresh with some new chips and new processors, but Apple saving the redesign for the Apple Silicon-based iMac, likely coming sometime next year. A few other possible updates we might see: a move away from the Fusion drives to all SSDs in the iMac lineup. I think that's long overdue and likely to happen. And we could likely see the addition of Apple's T2 security chip in the iMac lineup. And I think that's something also very likely to happen. Apple's been moving toward that trend of the T2 in their lineup across the board. So that's what I'm expecting to see when new iMacs come out. The big question is, well, will we see them by the time you're hearing this podcast next week? I'm a little bit on the fence on that one. I think Apple has them ready to go. Timing does seem about right, so I give it a 50-50 chance, in my opinion, but could happen soon. We also had some reports from DigiTimes that Apple has sealed deals with a super-thin, rigid PCB manufacturing partner, Tripod Technologies. What does that mean for you and I? Well, the idea is that Apple would use their boards in upcoming versions of mini LED backlit iPads and MacBooks, MacBook Pros. We've been hearing that Apple has been looking into mini LED technology. According to Ming-Chi Kuo, rather, Apple has been working on at least six upcoming mini LED-based designs: a 12.9-inch iPad Pro, a 27-inch iMac Pro, the 14.1-inch and 16-inch MacBook Pro updates, and a 10.2-inch iPad and a 7.9-inch iPad mini. We're expecting some of those updates to maybe happen this year, including those new iPads, the 10.2-inch and the iPad mini, maybe an update to the iPad Pro early next year, and the iMac and MacBook Pro updates, I think, would also be coming next year. But this Apple lining up this new PCB manufacturer is probably another next step toward all of that happening. And we did hear about that rumor this week. Future iMacs also may have new camera technology in the form of Face ID. This is according to 9to5 Mac. They noted references in the latest macOS Big Sur betas that list the term Pearl Camera. That is an internal Apple code name for the TrueDepth camera system and Face ID, so it's looking like Apple may be lining up to add that into at least some of their Mac lineup. They also saw references to Face Detect and BioCapture, just further evidence that Apple will be eventually bringing Face ID technology to the Mac. It's something a lot of people have wanted for a long time. It seems like the next logical step, and it does seem like it's taken Apple a while to get there, so I would imagine, you know, the timing feels right. Now, the question would be, again, is this a feature they're going to hold out for their new silicon Apple Macs, or will we see it in some of these new Intel models, like these rumored iMacs that might be coming soon? We're just going to have to wait and see on that one. Apple has always been a company that has been concerned about the environment and the planet, and as you likely know, those efforts were really stepped up when Tim Cook took over. He hired Lisa Jackson to head up their environmental initiatives, and they have been working on those for a while. Apple has been driving to be a leader in those operations for years, and you may remember about 2 years ago, they announced that Apple's own operations had become completely carbon neutral in terms of their corporate operations, their retail stores, and all of that. Well, this week they announced that they're going to take the initiative to the next level with a new goal to do the same thing for their supply chain. Apple made the announcement on their website with a 10-year plan to become carbon neutral across their entire business, manufacturing supply chain, and product life cycle by 2030. The main goals Apple outlined were low carbon product designs, expanding energy efficiency, focusing on renewable energy, processes and material innovations, and carbon removal. Apple plans to reduce emissions by 75% by 2030 and get the remaining 25% achieved by developing innovative carbon removal solutions. So they're going to do some credits. It's not 100% on the reduction side, but still a lofty goal. Apple is also making their roadmap available to other companies looking to reduce their impact on climate change. So they're going to be sharing their techniques. And again, this goes back to their desire to kind of lead the charge in their industry on these environmental initiatives. The ultimate goal is that every Apple device sold has a net zero climate impact by the year 2020. So Apple moving forward on those initiatives. Of course, if you're interested in this stuff, you can read all about it on Apple's website, apple.com/environment. Ming-Chi Kuo this week released a note to his investors detailing some potential changes coming to Apple's supply chain for the vendors who supply lenses for future iPhones. And while that's interesting, Apple changes their supply chain all the time. So for you and me, it doesn't really matter too much which company is actually manufacturing the lenses. But what was interesting about this note, and also in there, was a comment that one supplier, Semco, would be providing something called a periscope telephoto lens to Apple for use in their 2022 iPhone lineup. Now, this is interesting to you and I because it means that Apple might be possibly looking to expand the capabilities of the telephoto lens in the iPhone, the optical version of it. As you know now, we have a 2x optical, but you know, photography buffs and non-photography buffs alike would really like to see that extended. The problem is the dreaded camera bump. How do you do that without having a lens that sticks out or extrudes out from the device? And the answer is, apparently, this periscope telephoto technology. The technology would allow Apple to deliver a much higher level of optical zoom in future iPhone designs without having to have a massive camera bump, possibly up to 10x. We've already seen phones on the market using this technology that have up to 5x optical zooms. Apple describes periscope lenses as folded. Basically, the external optics don't change, but the lenses make use of the internal space and additional mirrors and lenses to provide focusing and zooming at a much higher range. So that is pretty cool. If we can get a 5x or a 10x optical zoom in telephoto on an iPhone, that would be a big change. Unfortunately, it looks like it's not going to be coming till 2022, so not the iPhone 12, not the iPhone 13, I guess the iPhone 14 seems a little long to me. You would think they'd be able to maybe incorporate this technology sometime next year, but that's not where the rumors are pointing. Ming-Chi Kuo also mentioned that the same company would be providing a voice coil motor technology that would also ship in the iPhone in 2022. So some interesting new things in the supply chain that could impact the photography on our future iPhones. Speaking of future iPhones that are coming a little bit sooner, let's talk a little bit more about this year's iPhone lineup, the 2020 iPhone 12. Latest information coming from Mac Takara. They say that Apple's LTE iPhone 12 models will be released in October, while there could be a delay all the way until November for the 5G models. They're also saying that Apple could delay the September announcement into October as well. So they're expecting, because of supply chain issues, because of the current world situation, that Apple may have to delay everything. Now, you might be thinking, Adam, this is a little bit different than some of the rumors we've been talking about and some of the things that maybe some other prominent Apple analysts and leakers have said that contradict this. And you would be right, because what's iffy about this report is that Ming-Chi Kuo has said that all of this year's iPhone 12 models, the entire lineup, would feature 5G. So why would we have LTE models and 5G models? That was something we hadn't heard of before. He also said about a month ago that Apple still appeared to be on track for a September announcement for the new iPhone lineup. I was suspecting there could be a slight delay in the launch timeframes, but that Apple still would hold an event in September, announce the devices like they normally do, and then maybe have a delayed ship date in October, early October. We have even seen them do late October, and that seemed to be the way things were going. This contradicts that, but I'm not putting too much stock in it. It is just something to be aware of and to talk about. Another thing that we talked about a little bit, I think last time with the new iPhone, was that we were starting to see or hear rumors about a braided USB-C to Lightning cable shipping in the box. And only the cable, right? Because we've been hearing that Apple's not going to be putting a power adapter in there, and also we're not going to be getting EarPods. So they'd be upgrading the cable to a braided version. We started to see some images of that this week leaked on Twitter. This would be the first braided cable that Apple has shipped with an iOS device, but you may note that Apple has had braided cables before. The iMac Pro has a braided Thunderbolt Pro cable and a black braided Lightning cable. Also, the HomePod has a braided power cable on it. So, yeah, I guess the general concept is braided cables are supposed to be a little bit more durable, a little bit more rugged. One thing that I noted about the pictures of the braided iPhone cable design was that it didn't have the little reinforcement up by the connector. So you know you have how you have the connector and you have the little rubber reinforcement that comes back from that. The images that were shown online didn't seem to have that, and that seems to me to be always the weak point. So I was a little surprised, even if they're going with a braided cable, that they wouldn't have that additional reinforcement. So I'm kind of taking this one with a grain of salt. I think Apple would keep that in there to keep those cables even stronger. I also personally, I've tried braided and non-braided cables. I haven't found braided cables necessarily to be more durable, but maybe that's just me. I don't know. I like the look of them. I like the style of them. They tend to be a little bit harder, in my opinion, to fold up or to loop. You know, they're a little bit stiffer, so you know, mileage may vary on that. I have a feeling some people really like the braided cables. They do feel a little bit more premium, but they, in my opinion, also have a few downsides. But we're going to have to see. It is sounding like they are going to be shipping this new braided cable, at least with the new iPhones this year. Moving on to Apple TV Plus news. Looks like Apple is picking up a new TV series. They put together a straight-to-series order for a show called Shining Girls, which is based on a 2013 novel by the same name. It's described as a metaphysical thriller. The show will star Elizabeth Moss, who you may know from shows like The Handmaid's Tale and Mad Men. The story is about a Chicago reporter who survives an attempted murder by a time-traveling Depression-era serial killer and then begins to hunt him, so sort of turns the tables. Moss will also co-executive produce the show along with Leonardo DiCaprio's Appian Way Productions Company. Apple also recently acquired the rights to a new Werner Herzog documentary called Fireball that will be coming to Apple TV+. The film is another collaboration between Herzog and Clive Oppenheimer, who he also did Encounters at the End of the World and Into the Inferno with. Fireball takes his viewers on an extraordinary journey to discover how shooting stars, meteorites, deep impacts have focused the human imagination on other realms and worlds and on our past and our future. There's no date given for either of these series, or the movie, I guess I should say, or the new TV series. So we don't know when they're going to be hitting Apple TV+, just that they are on their way. And also, we talked a little bit, I think, last time about the success of Greyhound, the new Tom Hanks World War II submarine movie that came out on Apple TV+. It was originally slated to go out into theaters via Sony, and Sony ended up selling it to Apple for release on Apple TV+. It's done very well. We got this week more reports that Apple, because of that, is stepping up their efforts to acquire more blockbuster films. The reports claim that Apple is on the lookout for more tentpole-like feature films, and they could make plans for releasing at least a dozen new movies a year on Apple TV+. So looking to put out about one new blockbuster film on Apple TV+ per month, which would be pretty amazing. That would help flesh out their content. We've also been hearing those rumors that they've been looking into back catalog, and obviously they've really stepped up their original series orders. We've been hearing just a ton of those. So despite what you think, and maybe what you thought before Apple TV Plus came out, yeah, it was light on content, but I have to tell you, and I think I've told you before, the quality is definitely there. They're keeping that up, and they are really starting to ramp up and I think spend the dollars. So, you know, I think they're going to prove themselves as a serious player in the space. I think their price point is good, and if they can continue this momentum, I think they're going to do quite well. Are they ever going to be at the level of a Hulu or an Amazon or a Netflix? Never say never. They seem to be on their way there. It's going to take a while, but they did something similar with Apple Music as well, right? A lot of people didn't put much stock in Apple Music, and look where that is now. So I think they could do the same thing with Apple TV Plus, but, you know, only time is going to tell. And then finally, in the news for this week, a little bit of controversy for Apple this week, although I think it's really minor. Details came out in the Washington Post when they leaked information from an unknown developer who broke their NDA about the new Find My App third-party integration feature that Apple announced at Worldwide Developer Conference. It was pretty exciting. Apple announced that third-party developers, makers of trackers, would be able to tap into and use the Find My app for their devices. What happened this week is that information came out that Apple customers who want to use the Find My app to locate their devices would not be able to also have their own app that would work as well simultaneously with that service. So the idea would be, if you want to tap in and use Find My app, you can do that for your device, but you can't have your own app. It would just integrate and work with Apple's app. An Apple spokesman said the software could be useful for smaller companies that don't have the resources to build a location finding service of their own. So obviously, the big folks who are going to kind of get upset by this are the folks who are already big in the tracking space and have their own third-party apps. Companies like Tile, for example. And the complaint, I guess, is that, you know, Apple is rumored to be working on their own hardware, and should that come out, they would be competing directly with Tile, and that, of course, would tie into Apple's app, would have more access to some of the low-level OS features, would not have some of the Bluetooth restrictions and other things that third-party apps might have on them. Of course, Tile would be more than welcome to take advantage of the Find My app, but then they would have to dump their own app, something they're probably not apt to do, especially given that they probably want some of that tracking data in their own database. And obviously, if they're going through Apple's app, they're not going to have access to that. I think that's another advantage that Apple has for, you know, sort of pushing their own system, is that they can keep our security and privacy in place. So I have a little bit of a catch-22 on this one. You know, I'm all for Apple opening it up. Do they have to open it up in a way that makes it easy for all of the vendors out there? I don't think so. I think this is particularly useful for smaller companies who want to get into the space and maybe don't have the resources to write their own app. They can opt into this. A company like Tile can build their entire whole own system and work outside of Apple. Now, again, one of the complaints and an example that was given is HomeKit, right? With HomeKit, you can have your own app, and you can also integrate with the HomeKit app if you want to, and take advantage of doing that in both places. And while that's cool and that's open, I kind of see that as a problem. I don't know about you, but, you know, I prefer using HomeKit 100% of the time. All of my smart home devices, I've chosen to go with HomeKit because I like that integration. And frankly, I hate any of the third-party apps. I have them all installed on my phone. I have the one for my LifeX bulbs. I have the one for the Nest. I have the one for my other devices, MyQ for the garage door. I don't use any of them. I open the Home app. I integrate everything through there. I actually prefer that experience. And I sort of see the Find My app being the same thing. If I'm going to get trackers, I don't care which third parties they come from. I'm going to want them all to work with a single app. This whole piecemeal thing with individual apps really breaks the user experience, in my opinion. It's a bad experience for the user. And so I, in some ways, don't have a problem with Apple sort of pushing this initiative that says, no, you're going to work all through our app. You can build your own hardware. You can do your own thing. We'll give you the APIs and the information to integrate with our app, but let our customers have the experience in a single unified way. And I frankly prefer that. I'd rather opt in, you know, I've done it on my own with HomeKit. I've chosen to go that route and not work with the other you know, outside apps. And I think it's great. So I don't even, I honestly don't even open them up. If I could delete them off my phone, which I think I probably can do, I would. I haven't actually tried that yet. So that may be the next step. I don't even think you have to have the third-party app installed for all of that to work. And that would be the case with these tile trackers. So, you know, it was a little bit of controversy. It's popped up this week. It's angered some people. Not really bothering me, but I'd love to get your opinions on it. Is this a big deal? Is it not a big deal? Is Apple, you know, is this just another example of Apple throwing its weight around? It might be to a certain degree. But when it benefits me as the consumer, doesn't really bother me that much. But I know it does bother other people. So please send your thoughts, your audio comments, your emails, your opinions to maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another show sponsor, and that is Smile. I want to talk to you about PDF Pen. Absolutely love PDF Pen. Look, if you work with PDFs, and let's be honest, who doesn't have to work with PDFs? You want a copy of PDF Pen. I think it's absolutely the best way to view and edit PDFs on your Mac, on your iOS devices. If you need to do things like annotation, if you need to add watermarks, if you want to add signatures, you want to do fill-in forms, you want to OCR your documents, you want to edit the contents of your documents, your PDFs, you could do all of that with PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro. And best of all, they've just updated it again. 12.1 is here, the latest version, and it adds some great new features, including the ability to do and have page label support in multiple formats for your documents. And then Pro users can take that a step further with the ability to add or edit their page labels. And of course, that's in the 12.1 update. The PDF Pen 12 update came out not long ago, and it added a bunch of other great features, things like a magnifier window so you can zoom in on your documents, customizable compression settings so you can really optimize your documents, something that you know often have to do. Great new feature. Stationery with new paper colors and custom page designs. Also, one of my favorites, great new markup tool in PDF Pen 12, the callout tool. It makes it really easy to add annotations with arrows and pointers to call out parts of your documents. It's great when you're working collaboratively, especially when you're working remote, like a lot of us are now. You know, you can't take the document over and sort of point at things, but with the new markup tool, easy to do. Send that in an email. You can annotate it, get information and get working on those collaborative documents and projects with your PDFs. And PDF Pen 12 works with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, so that allows you to go seamlessly across your devices so you can work when and how you want to work with Dropbox and iCloud syncing. And best of all, it all comes from a great company, Smile. They make great software. They're great people. You can learn more all about PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. That's smilesoftware.com/podcast. Check out PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro. Also, Text Expander, you know, their stuff's great. Go check it out. And a big thank you to Smile for their support of the MacCast. I want to talk to you a little bit about Apple Silicon. Rene Ritchie did a great video on his YouTube channel this week. I'll link to it in the show notes at maccast.com if you haven't had a chance to see it or you didn't run across it. It is really good. And he's talking about how Apple is not moving Macs to ARM. And you might be thinking, Adam, of course they are. They announced that at the Worldwide Developer Conference. And you would be mostly right, and I am totally guilty of making this mistake that Renee talks about a little bit in this video, and it's the misunderstanding about what ARM is and how that relates to what Apple is doing with Apple Silicon. Like I said, it's a great video, and it points out the subtle distinction between ARM processors and processor designs and ARM licensing and how all that works and exactly how Apple is using that and leveraging it to make chips for their own products and devices, including, of course, their iOS devices, but most recently for the upcoming Macs. And I've been guilty of calling these ARM-based Macs or ARM Macs, and that is technically wrong. So first and foremost, you may notice in the show I've been referring to them the way Apple does, which is Apple Silicon. And so rather than calling them ARM Macs, I think I'm going to start referring to them as Apple CyMacs because of the elemental symbol for silicon. So, and it more accurately represents what we're going to be talking about. So for those of you who don't know, I'll kind of summarize what's in Rene Ritchie's video, but definitely he is very elegant at explaining it and goes into a lot more detail than we're probably going to go into here. So check that out. But essentially, ARM is a company. They do not actually make processors. They have processor designs that they license out, chip designs, and they also have an instruction set that they also license out. So they sell licensing to other manufacturers to use their technology to develop products. And that's what Apple started doing when they started working on their own processors for iPhones and iPads. And originally they were using some of ARM's designs, their chip designs. So they were licensing that technology. They were licensing the instruction sets. Now they've moved on to just the latter part. So they're just licensing the instruction set. They have their own in-house team that is designing their chips. And this all changed in 2012 when Apple designed their very first CPU, the A6. And so prior to that, they were doing ARM-based designs and licensing those. When they switched over into their fully in-house designed chip with the A6, they started just licensing the ARM instruction set. And so we have been hearing that and saying that Apple is moving to ARM on their Macs, but what that means is that Apple is going to be designing their own chips that are based on and using the ARM instruction set. And just as an aside, something else that happened this week, there were rumors that Apple had been in talks at some point. So ARM is currently owned and held by SoftBank, and SoftBank is reportedly looking to sell ARM, and they had been in talks with Apple at one point to maybe buy the company. And it's not very expensive, I think, in terms of Apple money, but Apple has ultimately turned them down, basically because they don't want to get into the processor design and instruction set licensing business. It's just not Apple's core competency. And they don't really need to own the company. A lot of people were thinking, well, why wouldn't they buy the company if they're going to be, you know, building ARM processors? And again, that's the confusion, is that ARM doesn't build anything first and foremost, and Apple has their own chip design teams, so they don't want to be designing ARM-based processors for other companies. That would get into weird regulatory issues and those sorts of things, and so it just doesn't make sense for Apple to buy that company because of, you know, how they're operating. NVIDIA is reportedly looking to maybe buy them, and that could happen, but, you know, Apple not really interested. And that's because, again, what Apple is doing is they are designing their own processors. They're going to use the ARM instruction set, but they're really not quote-unquote ARM processors. They're Apple Silicon. They're Apple processors. And Apple builds into those a lot more technology than you would find in a typical ARM design and one of the hardware designs coming out of ARM. Apple's team includes things like their own GPU designs, something they started doing recently. And these are all system on a chip, meaning that all of these technologies are designed and embedded in the single processor, in the single chip. So they have their own neural engine. They have their own image signal processor. That allows them to do all the cool computational photography stuff they do. The secure enclave that controls the security on your iPhone. Advanced power management. Their own pro video coders and encoders. It goes on and on. If you want to see all of the things that Apple packs into the chip, watch the last Worldwide Developer Conference. And they've noted that they're going to be putting out a family of Apple Silicon for the Mac. It's not just going to be a single design. It's not just going to be single chips. And that's an important distinction. They can customize the silicon to match the needs of the hardware, the software, and the user interface. They can take all of those teams that work closely together and they can design the exact right processor for that machine and that feature and the features that it needs, right? So a custom Apple Mac chip, for example, doesn't have to match all the features of a custom iPad chip or an iPhone chip. And that gets a little bit confusing too, because think about what Apple's doing with developers right now. Their reference system that they're using to build, you know, that the Apple developer system, Mac Silicon, Apple Silicon developer system is, right, a Mac Mini with an iPad processor in it, an A12X, right? Ultimately, though, that's not going to be the processor that comes out in Apple's first Apple iMac, right? It's going to be a chip specifically designed for the Mac. And there's a lot of features of the iPad chip that probably aren't appropriate or don't even need to be in a Mac chip. And Apple can design and build that exactly how they need. They can, again, look to the software team and the things that the software team wants to do and the hardware team and even down to the folks doing user interface, and they can optimize every part of that chip design for that. And think about that. That is huge. That is a huge difference. That's a huge advantage to where they're at now with Intel, which is you have what amounts to an off-the-shelf processor that's designed to work in a myriad of systems, right? It's not custom designed to go with the OS and with the hardware it's going into. It kind of has to be generic, and then you kind of have to bolt on these other features and these other things, bring it all together, a lot of it in software to get it all to work, right? Firmware, all this sort of stuff. And so Apple is going to get to go past all of that when they're designing their own chips. And so, yes, we're going to get a lot of the advantages that come with the ARM instruction set and ARM-designed or Apple-designed processors in this case, right? In terms of, yeah, we are expecting faster processors. We are expecting probably more cores in terms of performance cores and energy efficient cores. And we're expecting Apple to do all the things that they do with those to give us really high performance, long battery life, a low thermal profile, so machines that stay cool. All of those things are expected to happen. But as Renee Ritchie points out, that's just like the tip of the iceberg, right? That's the underlying, that's like the base level. Apple has to do all those things. Otherwise, if they're not going to come out and beat what they're getting with Intel, they're going to kind of have egg on their face. Like, that's the baseline. But they're going to take it so much further in terms of what they can do with these processor designs. You know, think of all the innovations and things we've seen with the A series processors on iPad and iPhone. Apple is leaps and bounds ahead of the competitors because of those chip designs. You constantly see reports that, you know, the iPhone SE is beating out premium Android phones in terms of performance. So that kind of technology coming to the Mac is going to really be a game changer. There's really no other company that can tweak their chipsets based on the feature sets they want to deliver, right? So another great point that Renee mentions is, you know, Apple builds features, not chipsets, right? They're going to say, we want to have Face ID, and we need these technologies in our chip to drive that, and they can design that chip. So think about, you know, augmented reality, virtual reality, any things they want to do in those spaces, they can say, like, these are the features we want to deliver our customers. Help us design the components, the parts of the system on a chip that we need to drive that. Image processing, all of that sort of stuff. So it's really going to be an amazing, game-changing thing. And it's just something baffling to think about. And certainly, or I guess very likely, we've been a little bit underestimating the potential impact of that. And I think that was sort of brought to light to me this week. And I'm even more excited about it. I'm even more excited to see this new direction that Apple is moving in. But what do you think? You know, like, soak this in, go watch the video, and let me know your opinion. Share your thoughts, shoot me an email or an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. But, you know, I think this is even more exciting than it was before, and I am looking forward to seeing these first machines hit the market toward the end of this year. I know this has been a topic we've covered a few times here on the show in the past, but I wanted to bring something up because there seems to be a lot of confusion about optimizing storage as it relates to iCloud storage and iCloud Drive and iCloud Photo Library specifically. This came up this week because I received an email from a listener, and he asked if I could kind of go into explaining this a little bit and talk about some of the ways that Apple thinks about this versus the ways maybe many of us think about optimizing storage. And it's because Apple uses this term optimize as it relates to iCloud. And more or less, they probably are using it in the same way that you and I would think about it, which is to, you know, save space on your drive. But historically, if you're old school like me, you think about optimizers and you think about, you know, maybe something like Stuffit expander or zip compression, right? The idea of going through, if you need space on your drive, finding older files and compressing them down or optimizing them, you know, making them smaller so that they take up less space. But that's not really how or what optimize means when we talk about macOS and iCloud. Apple's version of optimize means basically, let's take storage that normally would be on your computer, files and photos that would be stored there on your internal hard drive, let's upload them to iCloud and then delete them or remove them from your internal device. Because we have a copy in iCloud, we'll give you a pointer to it. You'll still see it in your Finder. It'll still look like it's there, but we'll just deliver it back to you on demand. So if you need that file, you just click on it. It will download from iCloud, and then you can open it, right? It'll sync back down when you need it. When you don't need it, we'll just tuck it away up on our servers in iCloud, and we'll just get that off your Mac, and we will optimize your storage. We will give you your storage back. And I think that's a little bit confusing. I also think that the user interface that Apple has put together for managing this stuff can be a little bit confusing as well. So as you might know, you know, if you want to check this stuff out or you want to enable optimizing storage or just even you want to use iCloud storage in general, one of the ways you can access it is you can go to your Apple menu, you can choose About This Mac, and then you can click on the Storage tab. And then within the Storage tab, you can click on Manage. And this will bring up a little interface, and it'll drop you into something called Recommendations. So it's recommendations for storage and sort of how to save storage. And one of the categories in there is Store in iCloud. And if you click on that, it will give you the options to turn on Desktop and Documents, which will take your desktop folder and your Documents folder, which normally live in your home folder on your Mac, and move them into iCloud, and move all your documents and desktop stuff into iCloud. And then you also have the Photos option, which will turn on iCloud Photo Library, which will take all of your photos that are in your Photos app and sync those up and put them into iCloud as well. And both iCloud Drive, which includes, you know, your desktop and documents folder, if you choose to put them there, and photos have the ability to optimize their storage. Do this thing where you can turn on a feature, and if you run out of local storage, it will delete the local files and just leave the copies up in iCloud, and then you can access them like we said. Now, another confusing thing, remember I told you the user interface is a little bit confusing? In this same storage menu, right under the Store in iCloud option, is a section called Optimize Storage. This Optimize Storage in this screen is just for the TV app. It's not for iCloud. So you can click on that, and it'll give you an option to say, hey, stuff that I've bought on the TV app, you know, shows that I bought, movies that I bought, or TV shows that I bought, once I've watched them, don't leave them stored on my device. You have them up in iCloud. Go ahead and delete them from my local device and help me save storage. Also in the same screen, there's an empty trash immediately option and a reduce clutter option. The empty trash immediately option makes it so that if you leave stuff in your trash for 30 days, and I'm not this kind of person, it drives me crazy to see a full trash on a Mac. This is a conversation we've probably never had, just as an aside. Are you a, I always have stuff in my trash can? This is like my wife. She likes to leave files just in the trash can. I have to have it emptied. I have to have it cleared. So I think there's like always empty trash can people, and then there's people who have full trash can stuff. But the getting back to the empty trash immediately feature, if you check this on, anything that's in your trash longer than 30 days will be deleted permanently. It'll be like emptied from the trash. So that's another way you can save storage. And then the reduce clutter takes you to the storage interface where you can find sort of large files and things like that. But so just turning on iCloud Drive and storing desktops and desktop and documents in iCloud and photos in iCloud doesn't turn on the optimization features. Turning on those features, what it does is it means that, like I said, copies that are on your Mac will be synced up into iCloud. So another question was sort of like, hey, how does iCloud storage work? It is a syncing thing, right? It syncs up into the cloud. And that is assuming you have enough iCloud storage and enough space, or you buy enough to make sure all of that stuff fits in there. So that's just turning it on. Now, if you want to optimize the storage for iCloud Drive in this same window, you will see a section on the left called iCloud Drive. And if you click on that, it will give you another optimize button. Remember how I said the user interface is a little bit confusing? Yeah, you have to click on that. And then you can click and turn on optimize. Same thing for photos. Over in the left-hand side in this sort of storage management window, there is a photos section. If you click on there, you can also click the option to optimize your photos. And Apple really does seem to kind of push you to use the optimize option, but that's probably not what a lot of people necessarily want to use. You probably prefer that you keep your local copies as well as have copies synced into the cloud, at least with your Mac. Your iOS devices might be a little bit different, right? You probably want to optimize storage on your iOS devices, but as I've said on the show, it's really a good idea to make sure that you have a local copy of all your documents, all your desktop items, all of your photos on your Mac. And if you turn on optimize, there's a chance that that might not happen, because when you run out of storage and that is enabled, like I said earlier, it at the operating system, you're telling the operating system with that optimize option on that, hey, it's okay if I start to run out of storage locally, take files that I haven't looked at in a while, take, you know, photos that I haven't opened in a while. And it'll be, try to be smart about this. It'll look at things that you're not actively using. If you're actively working on editing photos, or you're actively working on certain documents or within certain folders, it'll choose to keep those local. But anything older that hasn't been touched for a while, it's going to say, all right, I can delete your local copy because I have a copy up in iCloud, and that will free up your storage. The problem with that, for a guy like me who is adamant about backups, is that that means that if you're using another backup system, a non-iCloud-based backup system like Backblaze, you know, you're backing up to the cloud, or a local backup system like Carbon Copy Cloner or Super Duper or even Time Machine, those documents are no longer there. Those folders are no longer there. They're not going to get backed up locally. So now the only place that you have a copy of those files potentially is in iCloud. And so you've now put all of your trust in Apple. And I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing. I trust Apple in iCloud. I think it's very robust. I don't think they're going to lose files. But the concept of backup is that you have more than one copy. And at that point, if you've got optimized storage on, you only have the one copy. And so in my opinion, my personal opinion, and actually a lot of professional opinions too, that's not a backup. that's just a copy in the cloud, and one copy in the cloud. And so that makes me a little bit nervous. May not make you nervous, but it's important to understand how this works. And that's the point of this conversation, is like making sure we're all on the same page with how this works. So if you don't want that, I know my general recommendation, like I said, is to have one place where you have a copy and then you do all of your backups out of. And I have that usually be my Mac. My main Mac has an entire copy of my iCloud photo library. It has an entire copy of my iCloud Drive documents. And it is a syncing system, right? So that will work. And so just be aware of that. The other annoying issue, and again, another user interface problem, is that once you've turned on all these features, so you've turned on, you know, sync, desktop, and documents, you've turned on iCloud Photo Library from this interface, from this little storage interface, you can't turn any of it off from here. So if you've enabled Optimize from here, you can't turn it off from here. You actually have to go to the individual apps to turn it off. So that means to turn off optimized storage for photos, you have to now open up the Photos app, go into the preferences there, and you can toggle optimize on and off from there. You actually can turn it on and off directly from there. Same thing with iCloud. You can go into System Preferences, go into your iCloud, and you can check the box that says optimize storage or not from there. So not all in the same place. Very confusing. They use the same terminology, optimize, in different sections. It's not always clear. So hopefully this conversation has helped clear that up, because that was the question I received from a listener this week, is can I make sense of all this? Can I kind of explain it? Another question that came up from the same listener, it was Justin, was about the manage storage feature. So I mentioned that in this screen, right, you've got on the left a bunch of sections that you can look at. iCloud Drive is one of them. Photos is one of them. They kind of separate your documents into different categories, or the stuff that's stored on your Mac into different categories. Another section in there is just something called Documents. And Justin asked me about this. So if you go, again, into the Apple menu, about this Mac, click on Storage, click on Manage, look in the sidebar, and you will see sections for Documents, and you will see a section for iCloud Drive. But the Documents size, the size under Documents, is likely much larger than the iCloud Drive section. And I noticed this on my Mac. I have about 200 gigs in Documents, and I only have about 100 gigs in iCloud Drive. And what Justin was asking me, because he noticed the same thing, is he says, well, I have the option to sync my desktop and documents to iCloud turned on. So shouldn't iCloud Drive have an exact copy of everything that's in my desktop and documents? And so why isn't the documents size exactly the same as the iCloud Drive size? And I thought, that's an interesting question. I don't really know, until I realized, again, confusing user interface. What's going on here is the documents section in this panel is all of the documents that are stored on your hard drive, not just the ones in your documents folder in your home folder. So they could be items that are in the system library folder. They can be items that are in, if you click on it, it becomes clear. You can kind of browse through it and you can see all the places that the documents are stored. But when you're first looking at it, it doesn't make sense. It's just like, I have all my documents in iCloud Drive, so why aren't those file sizes the same? And it was a great question, Justin. It baffled me for a second, got it figured out. They are looking at two different things. So your iCloud Drive should have and should account for, if you've turned on documents and desktop storage for iCloud Drive, it should have everything in there. So that's a kind of rundown of Optimize and that sort of thing. And that will lead us into our final conversation today. This came from John, and it's more iCloud Drive stuff. John ran into a rather frightening situation when you try to sort of undo a lot of the iCloud Drive. So if you've enabled iCloud Drive and you're using iCloud Drive, and maybe you're using the Desktop and Documents feature, and we're going to focus specifically on iCloud Drive now. And you need to turn it off for any reason. So in this case, John was running into some issues. He had to sign out of iCloud on his Mac for that. And he uses iCloud Drive and Documents and Desktop in iCloud. And when he signed out, you get this pop-up. And the pop-up can be a little bit scary. It says, do you want to keep a copy of iCloud data on this Mac? And then there's checkboxes for your various iCloud data, usually iCloud Drive and things like contacts. And typically, you're going to want to keep a copy if you're turning off iCloud and it's your main Mac. Because what it's basically asking you is, you know, we're going to disconnect from iCloud Drive. Do you want all of that stuff that was there to be stored locally on your Mac? And if you say yes, what it should do is it should make sure that, again, that sync happened, right? That all of the files that are in iCloud are also on your Mac, that you have copies of those all on your Mac. And I think this will happen regardless of whether or not you have the optimize option turned on or off. I'm hoping I'm right about that, but I think what will happen is if you've got optimize turned on and you're turning off iCloud and then you say, yes, I want a copy of everything in iCloud on my Mac, it should go through and pull all that stuff down. And this may have been where John ran into a little bit of trouble, because he said he checked the box, he said okay, it was taking forever for anything to happen, and he kind of got stuck in this endless loop where he kept checking and saying, yes, keep a copy, but it seemed like the copies were never coming down to his local computer. And he eventually ended up having to hard reboot his Mac. So he had to like literally power it down and restart it. And what was scary was when it booted back up, he had a lot of his files there, but some of them weren't. And so he was asking me about that. And I told him, you know, go in and look, because the other part of this is, even if you didn't choose that option to have everything pulled back down to your Mac, in theory, and actually not even in theory, in reality, all the copies will still be kept in iCloud. So everything will still live in iCloud. It just won't necessarily be down on your Mac. And I think what happened to John was when he did the hard reboot of his system, I think not everything from iCloud had been copied back down onto his Mac yet. And so it wasn't there. And so I told him, you know, just wait a little bit. It'll probably sync. And sure enough, he found the files in iCloud Drive. I don't know. He might have still had it iCloud turned off, so maybe it didn't sync. But he could pull those files back down from iCloud Drive manually, right? You can go into iCloud through your web browser, log into iCloud.com, and then you can pull any files down that you might need. So they're all going to be there. But what should happen is all those copies should be pulled down, stored locally on your Mac. And then it should turn off iCloud Drive and you should have everything. But because of all this, he asked for a rundown of how iCloud Drive works. And we kind of talked about that a little bit, right? The general idea is that it syncs data from your Mac to iCloud and then over to your other devices or Macs. And as we learned earlier, this can be different. How it does this can be different depending upon whether you have the optimize settings turned on or not. In theory, if you're not optimized, right, it should copy everything that's in iCloud Drive to your Mac and keep it in sync. And that sync should happen. And so you should have a copy on your Mac. You should have a copy on iCloud on Apple's servers. For your iOS devices, it's more likely that you're going to have optimized turned on, right? Because iOS devices tend to have a little bit less storage. And so over there, when you need a file, it will sync on demand, right? If it's not already locally stored, when you click on it, it will download it. You can work with it. Say it's a Pages document, you're in Pages, right? It'll download that Pages document. You can work on it in Pages. You can edit it, save it. It will sync that back up to iCloud Drive. It will probably keep that local copy because you're working on it. And then maybe a month or two later, when you're not working on it, if your iPhone needs more storage, right, it says, okay, I can get rid of the local copy. I can leave the copy up in iCloud. Should you need it again, you can reopen it. So that's kind of how the optimize works. And so, like I said, when you turn off iCloud Drive, you're asked if you want to keep those files locally. It will do its whole thing. Now, there's one other thing And so, John, hopefully that explains everything between this conversation and the last conversation. You should pretty well understand how iCloud Drive is working. And if you have additional questions, of course, please feel free to email me. But the other thing that I wanted to talk about was the documents and desktop folders that are in iCloud Drive. So if you've chosen to enable that feature, something that you need to know about, especially when you go to turn off iCloud, about those folders is that they operate just a little bit differently. They're kind of a special set of folders. And so normally your documents in your desktop folder, it lives in your home folder on your Mac. If you've used a Mac for any amount of time, you're probably pretty familiar with this. When you choose to turn on desktop and documents in iCloud, what happens is it takes those folders out of your home folder, it moves them into the iCloud folder, and then it does all its iCloud syncing. It syncs up everything, and syncs those to your Mac. Now, when you go to turn iCloud off, what Apple does is they don't do the opposite. And I don't know 100% why this is, but they don't just simply take your documents and desktop folder out of iCloud Drive and put them back into your home folder. What they do is they create new empty folders, a brand new documents folder, and a brand new desktop folder back in your home folder. Then they take your existing documents and desktop folders that are in iCloud, they move those into a iCloud Drive archive folder that they also create in your home folder, and they put them in there. And then what you have to do is you have to manually move any documents and any desktop items back into the new folders that were created inside your home folder. Again, why they have to do it that way, I'm not 100% sure, but that's what they do. And that has freaked people out too, because they'll turn off iCloud Drive, right? And then they'll go to look in their documents folder and they have no documents. Think how scary that could be. So they should be in another folder sitting right there in your home folder called iCloud. I think it's called iCloud Drive Archive or something like that. And you should be able to find them there. So that's the last thing to know about. Hopefully this explains everything you need to know about iCloud Drive, about optimizing your files, about file storage, how iCloud works, all that sort of stuff. It may have triggered additional questions for many of you. If you have those, feel free to email me, questions, audio comments, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I want to thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, Text Expander for iOS. You can get more information and details on all of their great software by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find, well, maybe not this episode, but on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline, that phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. I'll leave a voicemail there. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or find me on Instagram, MacCast on Instagram. But that will do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.